Welcome, this is Marcia for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading National Geographic Magazine dated November 2022. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the first article titled, These Birds Stage Rowdy Love-Ins on Rocky Coasts by Carrie Banks. For 36 years, biologist Ian Jones has been studying the crested owklet. The small seabirds flock in ocean waters between Siberia and Alaska. They nest in colonies on rocky coasts of remote islands. And each spring, they hold courtship displays that resemble rowdy carnal swim parties. Jones, a professor at Memorial University in Newfoundland, has observed the birds' 8-week breeding season, the sights, sounds, smells, and moves. In some, he says, it looks like some sort of 1960s-style lovin'. When the snowmelt signals spring, crested owklet males of breeding age choose a courtship staging spot, and the flaunting begins. The males puff up their feathers, strut around, and flash their forward curving crest. Its size does matter to females, research has shown. They also make trumpeting, hooting, and yapping sounds like a barking of small dogs, Jones says. If a female likes a male's show, she approaches him. If there is mutual interest, both birds pose and vocalize and stroke each other with their bills. That distributes a tangerine-scented substance released from a gland beneath their nape feathers. The smell may be an owklet turn-on, and the bird is already extremely gregarious, Jones says. You can have a 1 meter square flat rock with hundreds of birds on it, jostling, crowding, and doing all sorts of weird things. A couple's wooing usually leads to intertwining of necks, then mating, but never on dry land, Jones says. They do it frequently, several times in an hour, and always at sea. Not always alone, however. Sometimes a scrum of other auklets tries to thwart or cut in on the sex until the male backs them off with jabs of his bill. In a single season, the mates produce one egg, co-parent during the chick's early months, and often remain a pair. The next year, the same birds may find each other and do it all again. From what had been the emptiness of the eastern desert, the city projected a sedate affluence far more akin to suburban Dallas than to the clamorous pulse of historic Cairo. Another half hour further east, along a not yet fully paved highway, the new administrative capital sprawled before me. Still lacking a permanent name with only a fraction of its projected population of 6 million living there, the city being built nonetheless lies at the heart of Egypt's ambitious modernization plans. In a year's time, perhaps less, what also had been nothing but desert will shimmer with thousands of new residents. The spectacle will seem discordant with the everyday chaos that is Cairo. Here, everything will be orderly and polished and gigantic. The tallest office building in Africa, the continent's biggest mosque and biggest cathedral, a public gathering area twice as long as New York City's Central Park. There will be plenty of diversions, too. Museums, restaurants, and shopping malls, a sumptuously marbled opera house, and a library collection of more than 5 million books. Visiting Cairo and the beach resorts from here will seem effortless, thanks to a new high-speed rail system. Next article, These Birds Stage Rowdy Love-Ins on Rocky Coasts by Carrie Banks. For 36 years, biologist Ian Jones has been studying the crested owklet, Aethia cristatella. The small seabirds flock in ocean waters between Siberia and Alaska. They nest in colonies on rocky coasts of remote islands, and each spring they hold courtship displays that resemble rowdy carnal swim parties. Jones, a professor at Memorial University in Newfoundland, has observed the birds' 8-week breeding season. The next article from December 2022. Canary Islands, Spain, an island on fire raging in the dark. When cracks opened up in La Palma's Cumbre Vieja Ridge in September 2021, they set off one of the most destructive volcanic eruptions in the Canary Islands in 500 years. Karsten Peter arrived shortly after to cover the event, the 10th volcano he's photographed for the magazine. Over the next 3 months, molten rock splattered from the volcano's vents, while lava fountains blasted nearly 2,000 feet high. The eruption sent millions of cubic yards of lava on the march, bulldozing more than 2,800 buildings, 864 acres of farmland, and over 43 miles of road. Years of recovery now lie ahead for La Palma's roughly 86,000 inhabitants. Lunar Dreams, Kennedy Space Center, Florida. With its Artemis 1 mission, NASA is kicking off an ambitious plan to return humans to the moon. When the rocket launches this uncrewed trip's commander will be the Moonikin Campos, named after a NASA engineer who helped save the lives of the Apollo 13 crew. During a trip around the moon, slated to last more than a month, Campos is sitting in for crew in the Orion capsule. Sensors in Campos's headrest and behind its seat track vibration and acceleration, expected to reach four times that of Earth's gravity. Campos wears radiation sensors and the survival suit that future missions' flesh-and-blood passengers will use during launch recently, re-entry, and other critical moments. NASA hopes a crew of four will make the next trek abroad. Orion, as early as May 2024, as part of Artemis II. Corning, New York, ceramics that bend the mind. It's tempting to think of ceramics as strong yet brittle, like a coffee cup shattered on a kitchen floor, but to scientists at glass and ceramics manufacturer Corning, they're flexible and durable. The ribbon ceramics they've devised can be spooled into strips thinner than a sheet of paper. The loops of heat-tolerant alumina seen above could make automotive sensors and other devices used in harsh environments quicker and cheaper to produce. They could also enable new kinds of batteries. Line Islands, Kiribati, Resilience in the Deep. Around Vostok and other southern Line Islands in the remote central Pacific, abundant small reef fish support a thriving population of top predators. A gray reef shark swims over Montipora corals in a sea of Fusiliae damselfish and Bartlett's Anthias. Enric Sala, a National Geographic explorer in residence, visited the area in 2009 for his Pristine Seas project, which conducted the first scientific surveys of marine life around the islands and recommended protection. Now the sea around the islands is a reserve, which may have helped it recover from a dramatic coral die-off in the wake of a 2015-16 El Niño warming event. Next, Kili'i Yuyun. Survival skills and empathy help this photographer thrive in extreme environments and diverse cultures. I am gliding on ice, inhaling the crisp April air of Greenland's high Arctic, accompanied by the rhythmic whooshing of sled dogs. I kneel on the back of a sled, making photographs of Inuit hunter Kamaquakpeak Kuma Quist and his dog team. That's me, holding a camera. I'm on the quintessential National Geographic assignment, dog sledding across roughly 30 miles of sea ice in search of the unicorn of the sea, the narwhal. Week after week, we've been coming out on the sea ice of Englefield Fjord, seeking a path to where ice meets water. After 5 weeks, when we finally come up on a small area of open water, Kuma tests the ice with a heavy pole. It's mushy, but underneath the softness lies dependable ice. Our lives depend on that ice holding together. I decide I'll go first into the frigid water with one of the kayaks we've lashed to the sleds. Kuma and another hunter, Ilanquak, Quirnequak, give each other an uneasy glance, but they launch me anyway and watch nervously as I fumble around with my camera for a few moments. Then my kayak takes off like a shot. It rockets over the glassy water, coming to a stop only after I execute an expert turn with my paddle. Across the water, I can see the hunter's mouths turned upward. For years prior to becoming a photographer, I built and paddled traditional kayaks. They knew that, but now they're seeing proof. The Inuit launch their own kayaks, and we start searching for narwhals, spending the afternoon looking for signs of them around the water's edge. But it's a lost cause. The thin, rotting ice still extends way out of the fjord into the sea, preventing the narwhals from surfacing for a breath. They can't get into this area to fish for halibut or to give birth. In mid-June, I can't stay any longer. The thin ice remains in place, and the narwhals stay locked out of their calving grounds 2 months later than usual. As my plane gains altitude over the sea ice for the long return south, I look down and see dog teams mushing around the village, a seemingly timeless sight in this climate of unyielding change. North Greenland, home to the indigenous Inuit, is one of the few places on Earth where the most reliable form of transportation during much of the year is a dog sled. It might seem odd to most people. After all, dog sledding takes time, which means long exposure to bitter cold. Dogs need to be fed and cared for. Mushers also need to be trained and in good fitness. Nevertheless, the community of Kwa'anaak has remained, quite deliberately, a place where dog sledding is a common way to get around. Sleds are slow, quiet, and demand constant observation of the sea ice and its wildlife. Unlike snowmobiles, they don't break down, and when you get into an emergency survival situation, commonplace here, it's good to remember you can't eat a snowmobile. As a photographer of Nanai East Indian indigenous and Chinese descent, raised by my immigrant parents in the United States, I know how difficult it is to understand the perspectives of different cultures, but I believe it's essential. My mission is to try to understand how the thousands of wildly varied native cultures around the world manage to be so good at land stewardship, while this modern globalized culture has basically dropped the ball. The stakes for the environment we live in are high, and we all know it. The issues from climate change to habitat destruction seem dire, yet my friends know me as an optimist. That's because I see the solutions already out there and are in practice in this very moment. 80% of the world's existing land biodiversity is on territories managed by indigenous peoples, who make up just 5% of the global population. Nearly all of that territory encompasses people making a living with wildlife. This is where my hope lives. Native communities are incredibly good at stewarding their lands, and it's not because they are any more enlightened than anyone else. Indigenous peoples recognize human tendencies towards selfishness and greed. They have evolved all kinds of social structures, which one might even call technologies, to combat our destructive impulses. Indigenous peoples are not somehow magical, but they are exceptionally diverse. All those thousands of cultures represent individual experiments in how humans manage themselves and their surroundings. And when trying to solve thorny problems, possibilities are needed. Indigenous cultures also have had millennia to refine their solutions to problems, providing not only a variety of models, but mostly good models. It's hard to survive if you degrade the land that gives you life. In past centuries, indigenous peoples have stewarded their lands independently. Today, the threats their territories face are orders of magnitude greater. Mining, oil extraction, and development are rapidly eating away pristine homelands from the Amazon to the Arctic. It's my hope that powerful stories can help the industrialized world learn from indigenous models, as well as support native communities working towards solutions. Though I'm often engaged with heady thoughts like these, I remember that spring afternoon as we mushed across the ice and my mind was at peace. Our Greenlandic team paused to hunt a seal, feed the dogs with a blubber, and stew the ribs for dinner. On that day, we covered 30 miles on seal fuel. That, my friends, is a recipe not only for a great assignment, but also for good living. Next article, King Tut's Eternal Mystique, Luxor, Egypt. With winged arms and a protective spread, the relief of this Egyptian goddess, Isis, has stood guard for millennia on the stone sarcophagus of the pharaoh Tutankhamun. Isis has witnessed a great deal. Soon after Tut's burial in Egypt's Valley of the King in the 14th century B.C., grave robbers ransacked parts of the tomb. Then in 1922, a team led by British archaeologist Howard Carter rediscovered the burial site and fully excavated it. Nearly all of Tutankhamun's belongings now reside in the lavish Grand Egyptian Museum, which opens soon outside Cairo. The sarcophagus, though, remains within the necropolis, along with the boy king's mummy. Next, Weddell C., Enduring Mystery Solved. Explorer Ernest Henry Shackleton and his crew in 1915 all survived when ice crushed their ship Endurance off the coast of Antarctica. The three-masted, oak-hulled barkentine, long lost in the depths of the Weddell Sea, was discovered in astonishingly good condition nearly 10,000 feet down in March 2022. The Endurance 22 expedition, using autonomous underwater vehicles located the ship and spotted the brass lettering on its stern, well preserved by cold temperatures, lack of light, and low oxygen. The next ride to the moon, Kennedy Space Center, Florida. Shrouded in morning mist, NASA's Space Launch System looms over Kennedy Space Center's Launch Complex 39B in March as the rocket awaits testing. The 322-foot-tall vehicle is the linchpin of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to land the first woman and the first person of color on the moon and use it as a stepping stone to Mars. With two boosters and four main engines, SLS can fling a crew capsule moonward with an 8.8 million pounds of thrust, 15% more oomph than the Apollo program's Saturn V rocket. Each SLS will be used only once. After this rocket's launch during an uncrewed test flight planned for this year, its pieces are expected to either fall into the ocean or enter orbit around the sun. Next article, Erica Larson. Her work explores the bonds connecting cultures, people, and nature, in this case, gentle marine survivors. We'd sit at the water's edge on the seawall in front of Gina's family home and listen. Soon we'd hear them, gusts of breath when the manatees came up for air before sinking back below the surface of the spring-fed Florida Bay. I began calling them the sounds of the ancients, as these docile marine mammals' lineage leads back to grass-eating land mammals from about 50 million years ago. Yet, in the places that manatees inhabit today, many populations are seriously threatened. Writer-photographer Gina Steffens and I were paired at a National Geographic mentorship program in 2019 and had discussed working on a project together. I had moved to South Florida only a few years before, and Gina was living in Columbia. Gina had spent many childhood days in Crystal River, Florida, known as the manatee capital of the world, at the home that was originally her great-grandmother's, on land facing the waters of a manatee refuge. During the pandemic, she decided to stay at that house for a few weeks, and on a visit, we began discussing ideas. In 2021, declining water quality wiped out many of the Atlantic Florida seagrasses that manatees eat, and more than 1,000 perished in what was a particularly deadly year for the mammals. The same year, National Geographic approved our proposal to do a story on manatees, their essential relationship to the fragile Florida ecosystem, and where they're at risk or thriving. We made Crystal River our research base. Early in the morning, when I'd walk out, I'd be met by bursts of air from the surrounding water, the sounds of the ancients again. Gina's roots in Crystal River revealed a lifelong fascination with manatees, and I quickly gained inspiration by spending time in their environment. One headline that drew me in, "Nobody knows how to wean manatees off coal plants," on a Bloomberg Businessweek report about manatees flocking to the hot water runoff from coal and oil-fired power plants as natural hot springs habitats grew scarce because of coastal development. As we did research on relevant science, environment, history, we came across the work of scientist and National Geographic explorer Jason Gulley, who had been investigating issues surrounding manatees. After discussions with photo editor Kaya Bairn, Jason was added to the team. He would take underwater and aerial photographs to reveal manatees' otherworldly habitat. Meanwhile, back on land, Gina and I would immerse ourselves in the culture of what's become an almost mythical being, on one hand threatened, on the other larger than life. Zigzagging across Florida and ranging up and down its coastlines, we found a complex web of human encounters with and feelings about manatees. Crowds of fans describe them fondly as gentle, huggable, lovable, sweet. Marine conservationists dedicated to the manatee's welfare warn that it's a canary in a coal mine, an animal that's in great danger itself and is also a bellwether of the danger in its surroundings. Thanks in part to manatees' popularity, today Florida's effort to conserve them has broad support from zoos, aquariums, museums, the U.S. Geological Survey, power companies, universities, and more. The feature story on which we collaborated is to appear in the January 2023 issue of National Geographic. The visual storytelling will include Jason's laborious underwater imagery, as well as my photography from land, which ranged from documentary to more whimsical, vacation-style images that may jog our collective memory of Florida leisure. At the end of the journey, Gina and I found ourselves again sitting on the seawall, considering the manatee's story and where it might lead us. For me, manatees have become a guide showing me a new, primordial layer of this place where I live. Throughout our work on our story, they acted as mirrors to those who crossed their path, to the places where they live, and to our relationship with the environment that sustains us all. Below the surface, there are a small and unusual group of herbivorous mammals playing an essential role in our ecosystem. Above the surface, charismatic icons with the ability to delight, to enchant, and to reflect the best part of humanity. They are the ancients holding memories from long ago. The next article, Aji Stayawan. I grew up in Central Java. My first job was working as a travel guide for visitors, then for student interns from Europe. That's when I started using a camera, and then I knew I wanted to be a photojournalist. I began to freelance, but I wanted more training. In 2015, I got to go to Bali for the Foundry Photojournalism Workshop, where professional photographers teach students like me at low cost, and that's the start. In the workshop class taught by National Geographic contributing photographer Maggie Stieber, it's like I was a baby or blind or starting from zero, but I tried to learn and to hear every single word that Maggie said. At the end, there was a festival and awards for the best students in each class. Maggie called my name. Aji, I never expected anything like that. What? And then I was crying on the stage. A few months after that, a press photo agency asked me to be a freelancer. Then one client gave me an assignment, and then others. And in 2017, I started photographing the sea rise and flooding in Demak Regency on the northern coast of Central Java, in hamlets and villages not far from my home. Some 17,000 named islands make up Indonesia. On my home island of Java, coastal areas are threatened by deforestation, sinking land from groundwater extraction, and rising seas caused by climate change. A few years ago, the worst flooding in Demak Regency used to be from March until August, when tide waters entered homes for 6 to 9 hours a day. But in the last 2 years, it seems flooding has been unpredictable and has happened in other months. The ocean has engulfed thousands of acres. Once it was farmland, gradually it changed into fish ponds and mangrove forests. Now it's submerged by rising seas. When I went to take photos, the villagers told me, "So many media are coming here, and there is no change." After that, I've tried to make this project more serious. Sometimes I go without my camera just to talk to people. They are so angry after many years of nothing being done to help them. In the past, people here were farmers. Then they became fishermen. The flooding has changed their culture, their livelihoods. As I take pictures, they tell me how it was. "In this area, everything is green," Aji, one villager, says. "Everywhere it's coconut trees. They still remember in their hearts." A man working on a road with a hoe told me, "You know, Aji, when I was young, this hoe was meant for farming, but now he tries to use it to fix the road because of the rising sea level. And it can't fix the real problem because the water keeps undoing whatever he does." The young man now, the children, they are moving to the city, leaving this story behind. And some of the elders have had a chance to leave, but they don't want it. They say, "I will adapt to these conditions, whatever it takes. If I have to be buried, I will be buried here on the island of my ancestors." The flooding of the cemetery of Timbulskoye village made it hard for the living to visit the graves of their ancestors or bury their dead. Over the years, I have visited there many times. In September 2021, I photographed the razing of the cemetery, which was often underwater. Villagers removed the gravestones and, using earth-moving machinery from the government, added 5 feet of soil. They put each marker back in place and added a new fence. This could save the cemetery for 2 more years, some villagers told me, but 8 months later it was already washing away. Sometimes people say, "Okay, this is climate change," and maybe their home is far away, so they think it's not a problem. In Central Java, my home is about 9 miles from the coastline, and now the water's intrusion from the coastline is about 4.5 miles. It's halfway to my home. These villagers are my neighbors. I feel they are my sisters and my brothers. We are the same. Same life, same faith, same story. So people have to understand, if this is happening anywhere, it's a big, big problem to everyone. When I'm in my home, I always remember the people I have met while documenting this crisis of rising seas. I'll be taking a shower and think what the villagers have to do to get water. This year, their fresh water is going salty. I'll think, when they're asleep, there's water. When they eat, they're in water. And even in their cemetery, if their cemetery has been raised up when they die, they will be buried below sea level, and the holes that they dig will have seawater inside. But life must go on, and my job is telling their stories. Next, a moth's nightmare. A Townsend's big-eared bat may look conspicuous, lit up by a strobe light, but make no mistake, it's a stealth predator. The echolocating calls of C. townsendii are 20 to 45 decibels quieter than those of other aerial hunting bat species, according to work by Aaron Corcoran, a University of Colorado Springs researcher and National Geographic explorer who studies the evolutionary arms race between bats and their moth prey. As a result, moths are less likely to take evasive action as the bat draws near a scene. After closely approaching a moth, C. townsend reaches to grab the prey with its wing before transferring it into its tail pouch. Meal secured, the bat curls its tail to chow mid-flight. The entire sequence happens in about half a second. Stewards of their land. In northern Australia's Arnhem Land, Rosemary Nubulwad, R.J. Namabarabi, Margaret Nubulwad, Janice Nathorman, and Lorna Nubulwad crow marshy grasslands with long-handled crowbars to hunt turtles, a popular local delicacy. Turtle hunts happen during the hot, dry Kurung season, which begins in September when water has dried up and the reptiles retreat into the mud to keep cool. The five hunters, all family members, are rangers for the Wardekin Indigenous Protected Area, dedicated in 2009. The nearly 5,400 square mile reserve is managed and protected by its traditional Aboriginal owners. Early in the year, Indigenous work crews set small fires in nearby grasses to help keep future wildfires from raging out of control. For these rangers, 6 hours of hunting on their day off yielded only 2 turtles. Meadalir Valley, Iceland. A fiery landscape awakens. After lying dormant for 800 years, Iceland's Rakajins Peninsula erupted twice in less than 17 months, most recently on August 3, belching scarlet streams of molten rock into the uninhabited Meadalir Valley, and initiating what some scientists suspect may be decades of fresh volcanic activity. This concludes readings from National Geographic magazine for today. Your reader has been Marcia. If you've enjoyed hearing this content, please give us a call at 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.